This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It's no secret that at a time when even people with college degrees are having trouble finding a good job, the growing number of people who fail to even finish high school is a growing problem in many American cities.
I don't know what made me start to dislike school so much. I mean, I knew it was important, but I just wasn't willing to set school as a priority.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear what a city in Ohio is trying to do about the problem. We'll also hear from a high school senior who's been a target for colleges around the country for years. Then it's a trip to the lab, where scientists are trying to turn omics into personalized medicine. We'll also spend an academic minute staying happy. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Like many cities around the country, a growing number of high school dropouts is a tough problem for Toledo, Ohio. One of the reasons students say they leave is because a traditional school setting just isn't a good fit for them. But a Toledo Community College program is offering an alternative and challenging option: place high school dropouts in college classrooms. Amy Hansen reports.
Owens Community College staff member Michelle Atkinson frequently hands out a list of rules she advises her students to live by. They're printed on brightly colored laminated sheets with Michelle's 11 commandments written in bold letters across the top.
Never miss class, pay attention in class, pretend like you are interested even when you're not.
Atkinson is an advisor for the Owens chapter of Gateway to College, a national program that offers high school dropouts or students at risk of dropping out a second chance to finish their education by taking college classes. She says the program offers students an alternative when traditional schools just won't click for a variety of reasons.
They might have been having trouble socially in school. They might have been not challenged enough. So putting them into a college environment might actually put them into a little bit more independence, where they have to rise and meet the academic endeavors that they need to in order to succeed.
Students begin their gateway education with what's called a foundation term, where they take classes in reading, writing, math, and college skills. After that, once their high school requirements are met, students can begin to earn additional college credits towards a degree. Gateway Director James Jackson says it's a novel approach to helping kids at risk finish school. Rather than try to coerce them back to their public high school or steer them to alternatives like online charter schools.
Basically, we're taking students who were not successful in high school and putting them in college and expecting them to be successful.
Jackson says not everyone's a good fit, and not everyone who applies gets in. First, there are basic eligibility requirements. They must read at a minimum at the ninth grade level. They must have at least 5 high school credits under their belts. And they must be a Toledo resident between the ages of 16 and 21. Then there's a lengthy application process made up of placement testing, transcript reviews, and an in-person interview. That's where Jackson intensely listens for one indicator of success: how students talk about themselves.
Are they the victim in all of their stories? Are they the hero in all of their stories? Or do they have that balance that most of us have? And what I found is that, you know, some students have terrible home lives, background situations. We're talking abusive families, extreme poverty, you know, those kind of things. But despite all of those odds against them, they still believe that they're worth getting, you know, their high school education.
The Gateway program is funded through a few sources: a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, support from Owens, and a little more than $5,000 of state funding for each student from Toledo Public Schools. The program is partnered with the district and is free to students. The college and district coordinate which Owens classes are equivalent to traditional Toledo courses. 18-year-old Matthew Tamarine liked the sound of the program when he joined 2 years ago. Before that, he says, he had failed out of traditional high school, enrolled in an online charter school, and eventually dropped out altogether.
I don't know what made me start to dislike school so much. I mean, I knew it was important, but I just wasn't willing to set school as a priority.
Now Tamarine says he's on a good path to graduate by 2016, thanks in part to earning the best grades of his life last semester, a 3.0 GPA. He attributes his newfound success to the tools Gateway students get to help them manage their classwork, like tutoring sessions and regular meeting with peer mentors. They also get bus passes, a daily free lunch, and near constant access to staff members. But even with those perks, the program still loses some students each year. Last fall semester ended with 54 students. Only a little over 40 returned for the spring. But a record 6 are set to graduate this year. That's gratifying to advisor Michelle Atkinson and keeps her reciting those commandments every chance she gets.
I think sometimes those students just need to be challenged and put into the spot where they're maybe supposed to be meant to be.
For State Impact Ohio, I'm Amy Hansen.
Kimmy couldn't believe she was getting college info packs in the mail as a ninth grader. Having just transitioned to high school from middle school, she couldn't fathom thinking about college yet. But that's just what she was expected to do. Kimmy explores the twists and turns of the college preparation journey with all its stresses, frustrations, and joys.
One day, as a freshman in high school, I checked my email and I saw a message from a college. "Kimberly," it read, "our school wants you to apply." At 14, I certainly didn't feel ready to apply for college. But despite how I felt about it, I found myself prepping for college not too long after I received that first email. Now, as a senior graduating from high school, college seems to be all that people are talking about.
Every time I'm on Twitter,
Facebook,
Instagram,
everyone's talking about college.
It is the hot topic amongst friends, parents, and teachers. The journey to college was a long and grueling road, longer than most people realize. In my personal experience, this process has come in 5 parts. Part 1. Grades. Some students have a really hard time adjusting to their first year of high school and make academic mistakes that irreversibly affect their GPA, then their college, and then their resume. My high school sends over 90% of its students to 4-year universities, so the environment is one of focus, pressure, and expectation. Luckily, I went into my freshman year with a competitive spirit, knowing that I wanted to academically succeed. But I felt judged based off of my grade point average just as much as my personality. Besides taking an ultra-rigorous class load, it is also expected that students take leadership roles in clubs, excel at sports, master an instrument, rack up community service hours, and have a defining moment that you can write about on all of your personal statements. Showing evidence of school spirit is also a plus, so one should hold a class office, tech the play, or win homecoming king.
I'm on the robotics team.
I have started a few kids programs.
Well, I ran a marathon back in March.
I include bells because I play handbells.
Part 2. Test scores. Typically, the SAT or the ACT. One of the most dreaded experiences of the college application process for me was the standardized testing. I took a prep class for the SAT, completed practice SAT tests, and took practice ACTs. By the end of it, I never wanted to look at the College Board logo again in my life.
Every time that I took a practice SAT, my score went down by like 100 points.
I'm pretty happy with my scores, actually.
Just saying in my mind, don't panic, but I panic.
I thought it was ridiculously easy, too, but I turned out I only got like an 1800.
Each morning of a standardized test seemed to be the same. 8 a.m. Saturday morning. Instead of being in bed, I'd be at the high school, surrounded by my sleepy peers. The halls would seem colder than normal, and the usual buzz of social life was replaced with a thick tension of anxiety. I'd double and triple check my pockets for my number 2 pencils, my watch, eraser, calculator, snacks, ID, and test registration. I'd hear clicks of people whispering to each other.
I only did one practice test, and it took me 20 minutes, but I'm afraid I'll run out of time.
I'm scared I'll run out of time. The math one.
I'm worried about the math more.
Doors open, yeah. Conversations die. Students file in and sit 1.5 feet away from each other. The next 4 hours pass in a blur of mental exertion, ticking clocks, and filling in bubbles. Needless to say, I would have rather been anywhere else. By the end of the 4.5 hours, I felt
drained and upset.
My brain felt like jello.
Very apathetic.
2 weeks later, the results are posted online. Teens, and sometimes their parents, stay up into the early hours of the morning, refreshing their webpage to see the posted test scores. The first time that I saw my below average SAT scores, it affected my confidence, especially when some of my closest friends scored so highly on the PSAT that they were being nationally recognized. After a lot more practice, my scores went up, but it took 7 months to find out that the ACT was just a better test for me. If there was one thing that standardized testing taught me, it was that my test scores did not define me as a person. My score did not reflect my wit or close friendships, my dreams or aspirations. Yet, it was integral to getting into college. Part 3. Applying to the colleges. In the U.S. alone, there are 2,364 four-year degree-granting institutions. Narrowing down the application choices is based on a number of factors: average standardized test scores, school size, public or private, in-state or out-of-state, cost, available areas of study, and etc.
I wanted a school that had more cows than people.
Medium-sized, good student life, academics, of course.
Obviously academics, again, the community feeling, and small class size.
During junior year in high school, my friends visited as many colleges as they could fit into their spring breaks. They toured the schools, picked up brochures, met any admissions officer they could, and asked the pertinent questions, keeping in mind the specifics of which could appear in their personal essay. For me, I walked around the brick buildings of UCLA, and I fell in love. I came home from the tour, and I told my parents, "This is where I want to go." Being a dominantly USC family, my grandmother was slightly aghast at the thought of her own granddaughter applying to the rival school. Once I decided where I would apply, I began to undergo the process. I filled out the common application and supplements, wrote personal essays, answered short response questions, requested letters of recommendation, created a resume outlining all of the extracurricular activities that I was involved in, and sent transcripts and test scores to all of my schools. With the number of schools that my friends and I applied to, it was easy to feel overwhelmed by all of the paperwork. Unlike my mom and dad, who applied to maybe 3 colleges each, I applied to 14. My peers applied to
15.
10.
9.
6. As many as I possibly can.
And as a chronic procrastinator, it took me from July to January 1st, the very last day possible, to finish applying to all of my colleges. Part 4. The wait. For those who did not apply early action or early decision to a college, the month of February can be the longest month there ever was. All of my work had been sent off to unknown boards of people to judge and either accept or reject me. My unknown future put me on edge, counting down the days until I would finally just know. Part 5. The results. By April 1st, all of my results were in, and I received 11 admissions and 4 rejections. Rejection in life is always a possibility. Instead of letting it define me, I'm proud that I challenged myself, and proud that I took a chance working towards a successful future. I'm looking forward to starting the new chapter of my life at UCLA. But mostly, I'm relieved to be finished with the college application process. This has been a product of Open Orchard Productions. I'm Kimmy Rich. If you'd like to hear more teen-created stories like this one, please visit our website at www.openorchardproductions.org.
Still to come, scientists who are trying to perfect so-called personalized medicine are concentrating on omics. We'll explain next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1238. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. It's time to get a little technical and talk about omics.
If you've never heard the term before, well, don't feel too left out. Clinical scientists have been using omics to try and perfect personalized medicine. Here to talk about this brand of science is Dr. Patrick Bossuet, professor of clinical epidemiology at the Academic Medical Center, University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He has written an article on omics in the journal Clinical Chemistry. We spoke recently and I asked him to define omics.
Well, omics is a term that refers to a number of disciplines that try to characterize sets of molecules and sets of biological molecules such as DNAs, RNAs, proteins. One example is genomics, which investigates DNA sequences, but we also have transcriptomics, looking at gene transcripts, and proteomics, we're a discipline that looks at proteins, and metabolomics, a discipline that looks at metabolites. So these disciplines are relatively new. They gathered force in the mid-90s, and a typical element of these omics-based disciplines is that they generate high-dimensional data. In most cases, there are more variables, more data points than study participants or study samples.
In your article, you mention a report from the Institute of Medicine on omics-based predictors in clinical trials. Why was that report written?
Well, the omics-based disciplines gathered force because people were looking forward to personalized medicine, where these large sets of data could be used to develop predictors that could identify patients who benefit from therapy and separating them from those who do not benefit from therapy or are even harmed by therapy. So the essence of stratified medicine or personalized medicine. But as it turned out, actually there were a number of failures where omics-based predictors did not perform as well as expected. And this report from the Institute of Medicine was set up by a committee to learn from these failures in the past and to identify criteria and other initiatives that could move the field forward. It was in particular written after a series of rather dramatic events at Duke University.
Well, could you tell us what happened at Duke University?
Well, researchers at Duke University were involved with the discovery of omics-based predictors, and they also wanted to take the next step, which means that they were planning on using omics-based predictors in clinical trials. So between October 2007 and April 2008, there were three cancer clinical trials launched at Duke University. And in these trials, patients with lung cancer and patients with breast cancer were assigned to a chemotherapy regimen on the basis of the results of omics-based predictors. Now, a number of researchers voiced concerns about these omics-based predictors because they failed to reproduce the results in their own lab, in their own institution. And later, 30 researchers wrote to NCI, again voicing concerns, which were later confirmed, because it turned out that these omics-based predictors were not entirely fit for purpose, that several things had gone wrong in the development of these predictors, and that patients had been prematurely included in these clinical trials. So in short, these three cancer clinical trials should never have gone forward based on the evidence that was available at the time of their initiation.
Doctor, could you summarize for us the key elements of that report from the Institute of Medicine?
I think the report looks back at what went wrong, but it also looks forward, and it presents a number of criteria that can be used to verify whether omics-based predictors are fit for purpose, or maybe not yet fit for purpose, but when they can be used in clinical trials with actual patients. And a short version of that checklist appeared in Nature last year. And that checklist contains about 30 criteria that people can use to see whether omics-based predictors are ready to take the next step, whether they are ready to be used in clinical trials. So these 30 criteria look at different elements in the discovery phase and the validation phase of these omics-based predictors. They look at the technical features, but also look, for example, at statistical features.
Finally, Dr. Bossuet, will this report bring us closer to personalized medicine?
I think the report is a very good step in right direction. It clearly shows that there are pitfalls and potential failures in the discovery phase and the validation phase of these omics-based predictors. These are, as I said in response to your question, these are high-dimensional data and many things can go wrong. So the use of the report and the use of the checklist in that report will help researchers to avoid some of these pitfalls. Whether it actually will bring us closer to personalized medicine is an open question, because in general, the development of these omics-based predictors, and especially introduction of predictors that improve patient health, has been much slower than everyone expected. And probably there are other reasons, in addition to these pitfalls, that can help explain why it is so difficult to build on the technological innovation that we have seen and the development of all these omics-based disciplines. So as a future patient, I hope that the promises by these omics-based disciplines to bring us closer to personalized medicine will materialize in the years to come. But I think it will take much more time than anyone anticipated.
Dr. Patrick Basut is professor of clinical epidemiology at the Academic Medical Center, University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Well, if you want to avoid getting sick altogether, just be happy. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Just how connected are happiness and health? Julia Bohm, assistant professor of psychology at Chapman University, takes a look at the connection between psychological well-being and physical health.
Although being happy inherently feels good, do happy, more optimistic people enjoy tangible benefits beyond simple pleasure? In the context of cardiovascular disease, which is the leading cause of death worldwide, it does indeed appear that happier people enjoy better cardiovascular health compared with their less happy peers. We have found that among initially healthy individuals, those who report the greatest levels of optimism, satisfaction, and emotional vitality have a reduced risk of experiencing a heart attack, stroke, or cardiovascular-related death approximately 5 years later. Moreover, in patients already diagnosed with cardiovascular disease, those with greater levels of well-being show a slower progression of the disease over time. Notably, these associations persist despite accounting for traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as cigarette smoking, socioeconomic status, and depression. Why are psychological well-being and cardiovascular health related? Happier, more optimistic people tend to have healthier biological function and engage in healthier behaviors. For example, we find that the most optimistic middle-aged men and women tend to have healthier levels of blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, and carotenoids, which are antioxidants found in brightly colored fruits and vegetables. Furthermore, happier, more optimistic individuals are less likely to smoke cigarettes and are more likely to be physically active and eat healthier. In sum, greater feelings of happiness, optimism, and satisfaction confer tangible cardiovascular benefits. Although more research is needed about how psychological well-being protects against cardiovascular disease over time, our findings have important implications for prevention and intervention. In addition to repairing psychological deficits like depression, bolstering psychological well-being may help to foster cardiovascular health.
That was Julia Bohm of Chapman University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.